It is a great pleasure to introduce our next instructor based in New York. In addition to being head of research at Firebird Management, Steve Gorelick is the fund manager of Firebird US Value Fund, as well as portfolio manager of Firebird's Eastern Europe and Russia funds. He joined Firebird in 2005 from Columbia Business School, while completing education from a highly selective value investing program. Prior to business school, Steve was an operational strategy consultant at Deloitte, working with companies in various industries, including banking, healthcare, and retail. On behalf of the MOI Global membership community, a very warm welcome back to you, Steve. The floor is yours. Please go ahead.
John, thank you very much for a kind introduction and another opportunity to present at a Manual of Ideas event. Today, I would like to present our thesis on Harley-Davidson, a company that we believe has a strong moat and is trading at an attractive valuation. But before I do that, I would like to spend a bit of time on our framework for identifying and assessing different types of competitive advantages. First, about our fund and our investment process. Just like most value investors, we focus on quality and value. From quality point of view, we spend time on identifying moats and trying to understand what the company is doing to maintain or enhance the competitive advantage that it has. Connected to that is our valuation criteria, which are based first and foremost on the cash flow generation of the company and what the company does with the cash from a point of view of either investing it in high ROIC projects that extend competitive advantage or returning it to shareholders. In addition to the two factors just mentioned, we also spend more time than the average value investor on macroeconomics and a general operating environment for the investee company. Our firm's background is in emerging markets, and paying attention to economic environment has been the key to the success of our investment approach. Before I speak about Harley-Davidson, I would like to spend a bit of time on the topic of competitive advantage. Michael Porter identified two broad types of competitive advantage: lower cost and differentiation. He also talked about focus, but that is a subset of the first two advantages for the niche market. These competitive advantages can take many forms, and maintaining the competitive advantage is just as important as having it in the first place for the success of the investment. We believe that the competitive advantage has to come from one of the following sources: hard assets, intellectual property, or customer captivity. Hard asset-based competitive advantage would usually come from either natural resource, PP&E, or established distribution network or scale. Natural resource advantage usually applies to commodities and allows companies to produce a good cheaper than a marginal cost producer. A good example of this are Russian oil companies that are able to extract oil at $4 to $5 per barrel, while deep sea drillers or the U.S. shale producers extract at a cost closer to $60 to $70 range or even higher. Another example are U.S. companies like fertilizer producers that are using cheap price of natural gas, the major input, to produce fertilizers at a price well below global average. Advantage based on PP&E comes from ownership of assets that can no longer be reproduced, either due to the fact that it is uneconomic at prevailing product prices or due to regulatory changes. A good example of such advantage is the situation with U.S. refiners. There's very little chance of another major refinery starting in U.S. due to regulatory concerns. Any industry which trades at below replacement cost of its assets is a good place to look for high-quality companies with these advantages, but profitability is definitely something of a concern in these cases. The third hard asset-based advantage comes from distribution network, which in itself is a form of PP&E, but also contains elements of know-how that we will discuss when we're talking about intellectual property a little bit later. Companies with competitive advantage from distribution network can often be found in large consolidated industries with stable market shares. Top three drug distributors controlling over 80% of drug distribution in the U.S. is a good example of such industry. Moving on to intellectual property, First type of advantage that comes to mind is patents, most often associated with drug development. These patents give drug companies a monopoly and allow them to charge whatever market will bear for the duration of the patent. While very powerful during the term, the advantage coming from patents is not sustainable since patents do expire. On the other hand, trademarks and content-based competitive advantages are more sustainable, especially if the company is investing in keeping the perceived value at a higher level by developing additional content. Disney is a good example, since they're masters at both creating and maximizing the value of the IP they possess. Competitive advantage can also come from regulation, which either limits possibility of new entrants or creates heavy burden on existing participants. As an example, most fintech companies will have to figure out AML and KYC procedures in order to remain compliant with US laws. Incumbents like banks or Western Union already have the processes in place to make sure they're compliant, and their profitability is higher as a result. The last category of intellectual property-based competitive advantage is a bit of a catch-all. Know-how is what the companies have learned over the years of offering their products to the customers and effectively competing with other players. The best companies take advice from their employees in the trenches, which helps them generate more profits over time. The ones that do perform and serve their customers better. One example of company that possesses such competitive advantage is Walmart, which sources ideas from their millions of employees on how to improve processes in order to deliver everyday low prices to their customers. In terms of customer captivity-based competitive advantages, I believe there are two broad types. One comes from brand affinity, where customers know they can rely on a particular brand for a certain quality. The other from customer learning, where users take time and effort to learn how to best use company services. A good example of a lesser-known company with brand affinity is VeriSign, the company that makes sure that every .com and .net address leads to a proper website. VeriSign's pricing power comes from an exclusive contract granted by ICANN. While contract renewals are not guaranteed, the risk of going with another unproven provider for ICANN is just too high, and the contracts do get renewed. An example of competitive advantage based on customer learning is any distribution company that is directly plugged into the process of their customers. Dentist practices rarely switch supply providers from either Henry Schein or Patterson due to the fact that the office was more often than not set up by one of these companies in the first place, and consumable supplies renewals are seamless and easy through the existing provider. In most cases, the process of identifying competitive advantage is not trivial. Trying to understand whether what the company is doing and whether it's doing the right thing in order to maintain the moat in place is even harder. We have developed a checklist, a portion of which you see on this slide, that looks at management's actions and incentives of all stakeholders in order to help us understand where advantage is coming from and whether it's still relevant. You also see a small chart that we're using for our whole portfolio to try to understand and see where the competitive advantage comes from that also helps us focus on what happens to the competitive advantage and how it's maintained once the investment makes it into the portfolio. Now that we've spent a little bit of time on competitive advantages, I would like to speak about a company with a competitive advantage, which is Harley Davidson. Harley-Davidson, in a lot of ways, does not need an introduction. Founded over 100 years ago, Harley became synonymous with large motorcycles and the idea of the open road. This is one of the most recognizable global brands, thanks to the perception and the global network of dedicated dealerships. Harley has 50% market share of large motorcycles in North America, a level that they've been keeping for over 20 years. Harley-Davidson also includes its finance arm, Harley-Davidson Financial Services, which finances over 50%, more recently 60%, of all Harley sold, and delivers operating results on par with the best financial companies in the U.S. Harley-Davidson Motor Company manufactures its iconic motorcycles in the United States and also has 3 assembly plants in emerging markets for the bikes to be sold in Latin America and Southeast Asia. Since the demand for their bikes is not expected to grow exponentially, Harley does not need to spend significant resources on maintaining its PP&E beyond the $250 million of maintenance capex, and is able to generate significant free cash flows from its manufacturing operations. Since 2011, in a depressed demand environment, Harley-Davidson was able to generate over $5.5 billion of free cash flows and pay it out to shareholders in the form of dividends and share buybacks. $5.5 billion since 2011 is 77% of current market cap, and we believe the company is extremely undervalued. So where does Harley's advantage come from? I believe there are two sources, scale and brand affinity. Scale that comes from 50% market share and the largest dedicated dealer network allows company to spread the costs and maintain high operating margins. Harley has around 700 dedicated dealers in the US and over 1,500 globally. No other motorcycle brand has a dedicated distribution network such as this one. Other manufacturers sell through multi-brand dealers, which makes it hard to establish and maintain corporate identity. Thanks to its dominant share, Harley can afford to spend more than anyone else in the industry on R&D. It spends over $170 million per year, which is still only 3% of their sales. Differentiation comes from brand, which is synonymous with large motorcycles. You can see the power in differentiation in both sustained market share and in pricing power. Average revenue per motorcycle has gone up by 2.7% per annum on average since 2007. Harley dedicates a large portion of dealership space to selling apparel, an important part of maintaining its brand image. At the end, what other brand can claim to be the second most popular tattoo after the word mom? Harley-Davidson's competitive advantages translate into superior returns. As you can see from the charts below, Harley-Davidson routinely generates high ROIC and operating margins than other players in motorcycle and motorsports industry. Most of the cash that is generated is not needed for sustaining the operations and is returned to shareholders. In order for the investment to work, it is important to both create and maintain competitive advantage. As I already mentioned, brand value is reinforced through licensing and cross-branding initiatives. Harley collects $30 to $40 million per year in licensing fees, which means marketing is actually a source of revenue rather than the cost for the company. The brand is featured in TV shows like Sons of Anarchy and is used by consumer brands to create an edgy image. R&D spend of $170 million per annum sustains premium image and technological leadership. Some of this investment is going towards Harley's first electric motorcycle that is coming out in early 2019. Being the biggest allows Harley to spend most on innovation without threatening overall profitability. Just for comparison, the $170 million of R&D is equivalent to 30% of Polaris's motorcycle sales. Polaris is the maker of Indian motorcycle, which is considered by some to be a credible alternative to Harley-Davidson in the United States. Harley is also working hard to create the next generation of riders with the goal of introducing 2 million of new riders to the brand over the next 10 years. One of the ways they're doing it is through Harley-Davidson Riding Academy. People who go through the Riding Academy have a natural brand affinity for Harley as a result. As I spoke about in the introduction, Harley is not one but two great businesses. In addition to manufacturing motorcycles, company also finances about 60% of Harley's sold through Harley-Davidson Financial Services. The average ROE of the financial services company usually hovers around 18%. We expect it to go up to 23% as a result of positive changes to U.S. tax laws. The financial services company is the source of most of the debt on Harley's consolidated balance sheet, which distorts EV EBITDA multiple for the company. In 2017, the finance company generated operating income of $275 million. We will speak about Harley-Davidson Motorcycle Corporation a little later, but spending a bit more time on HDFS. Unlike other captive financing companies, Harley-Davidson Financial Services exists to generate profits, not subsidize motorcycle business. It is the primary financing option for the new Harleys purchased, and in recent years provided financing for over 60% of all new bikes sold. They also provide wholesale funding for dealer inventories. When we think about HDFS as a bank, we see a company generating superior net interest margin of around 6% while incurring a relatively low cost of risk despite having subprime exposure. Cost of risk is 1.9% and provision cover of 90 days past due the past due loans, 90-day past due loans, are covered by almost five times by provisions. Subprime represents 16% of overall loan book, which is down from a slightly higher level in recent years. Historical ROE of this business is around 18%, and it will go up to estimated 23% starting this year due to lower taxes. In Q1 2018, ROE of HDFS hit 27%, which is 5% higher than Q1 2017. Harley-Davidson Financial Services is not aggressively levered and has an equity over assets ratio of 16%, much higher than a typical bank. I believe HDFS is an excellent and very valuable business on its own. The motorcycle company possesses the brand image created through differentiation and is attractive to a relatively wealthy subsegment of the population. They have been able to grow average revenue per motorcycle by about 3% in the last decade, partially thanks to the customers trading up within the product range. Harley-Davidson enjoys operating margins nearly double that of its peers, primarily due to its ability to spread fixed costs over a much higher number of motorcycles, thanks to its 50% market share. They generate ROICs well above the cost of capital and pay out free cash flow at a rate of equivalent to about 9% of current market value. The motorcycle company itself has little leverage, with only about $700 million of non-financial debt on Harley's balance sheet. The debt is offset versus about $400 million of cash, which company held at the end of the year. The level of debt is below one times book, and a company could easily handle more leverage if it chose to do so. Moving on to value, but before we speak about that, let's speak about some of the perceived problems that the company has. One issue that is an occasional concerns about market share and whether Harley still offers attractive proposition to bike riders. The chart on the left shows Harley's quarterly market share, which fluctuates around 50% and occasionally trends down, causing concerns from the subsegment of the investor community that focuses on short-term results. The chart on the right shows 20-year view of Harley market share, and it is clear that it usually fluctuates around 50% with relatively little variations. I do not think that any recent changes in the market share is a sign of significant changes in customer preferences, and Harley's market share going forward should stay at around the same level. The other and bigger concern is the motorcycle market itself. U.S. large motorcycle sales are still 45% below their 2006 peak and have been trending down in the last 2 years. Many industry observers are wondering whether demand for motorcycles is permanently damaged due to changing preferences of younger consumers. I am bullish on the long-term motorcycle market, and I believe that the current sales levels in North America are about 20% below normalized levels. There's a few reasons for it. First and foremost, while number of new motorcycles sold have dropped by more than 40% since 2006, overall number of large motorcycle registrations is up significantly since 2006 and has been stable in the last few years. In fact, number of new motorcycles as percent of total registration has fallen to below 6% from as high as 16% before the crisis. We also believe that there is no strong evidence of changing consumer preferences. Yes, there are statistics that show that baby boomers are four times more likely to ride a motorcycle as millennials. And while that is true, the statistic does not take into account that many millennials are not yet in a stage of their life where they would be interested in motorcycles in the first place. In fact, data from Harley-Davidson suggests that millennials are riding more than baby boomers did at the same age. As this population cohort ages, their interest in motorcycles should increase. Moreover, the population is getting older, and the cohort in the ages of 35 to 55 is about to start growing after years of mild decline. This should be supportive for motorcycle sales. Harley-Davidson is investing into the future by training riders through Riding Academy, something that I already mentioned, and claims that they have increased number of Harley riders by 32,000 2017, despite falling sales year over year. Every Harley rider for a used motorcycle is a customer for a new motorcycle at some point. Thanks to lack of new motorcycle purchases, average age of motorcycles on the road is getting closer to 12 years old, and is pushing expected useful life of our motorcycles. There have been tremendous technological improvements in quality of motorcycles about 20 years ago with the introduction of twin cam engine, which led to the expansion in average age of bikes on the road. But the positive impact of this switch on average useful life is largely behind us, and maintaining total number of bikes on the road at the same level will require much higher new purchases. Moving on to valuation. As I already mentioned, I believe HDFS is a very attractive and profitable business. Based on their historical ROE and where other specialty finance companies trade, I think it is worth around 2.5 to 2.6 billion. Excluding this value and the relevant debt, motorcycle business is trading around 7.7 times 2018 EBITDA. 2018 sales are expected to be lower than 2017 based on Harley's guidance. On a normalized basis, EV EBITDA of a motorcycle business is somewhere around 5.5 to 6 times, which we believe is very attractive for a company that generates an average ROIC well above cost of capital and distributes all free cash flow to shareholders. I made this point a number of times already, but I believe that the fact that Harley generates and distributes significant free cash flows should not be overlooked. FCF after CapEx routinely exceeds 10% of current market cap, even at current depressed levels of demand for motorcycles. Current company currently trades at 3.5% dividend yield, and it bought back close to 30% of all shares outstanding since 2011. From a valuation perspective, I believe that investment in Harley should generate mid-teen IRRs in medium term, assuming no change in market multiples and partial return of motorcycle market to historical trends. The DCF exercise comes up with a fair value of company of $55 to $60 per share. In summary, I believe Harley is a company with a strong moat in both cost and differentiation. By buying Harley, we are buying two great businesses, not just one. I believe market for new large motorcycles in the U.S. is about 20% below normal levels and is poised for recovery in the next few years. The company is trading at a very attractive real yield and provides an opportunity to invest in a unique business at a high IRR. Thank you so much for an opportunity to present.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for such a clearly articulated thesis. Maybe a question on capital allocation and whether there's anything you might prioritize differently than the management is doing right now.
Thanks for the question. As I mentioned many times before, let me go to that slide. The company spends whatever it needs on CapEx, which is about $200 to $250 million per year. Over the next couple of years, the spend is going to be a little bit higher because they're consolidating the U.S. Production in one plant versus two. But they're pretty much spending whatever they need to spend on maintenance CapEx. The rest of the money goes towards dividends and buybacks, most of it in buybacks. And as a shareholder and a person who believes that the company is undervalued, I believe that buying back shares with all free cash flows is a great idea. So from that point of view, I am a big fan of what the company is doing in terms of capital allocation. They think they've tried acquisitions in the past. They weren't big and they didn't really work out too well. There may be an argument for them to buy in some of their dealers, but that is usually not the best use of capital. So I think the company is doing exactly what it's supposed to be doing and increasing the intrinsic value of each share that I own.
Could you shed more light on management incentives, please?
In terms of management incentives, I believe they are incentivized on overall profitability and profitability per share. I don't have those numbers in front of me, and I would love to follow up a little later.
Certainly. Thank you. What data points are you tracking to either validate or challenge your thesis, or what data points should folks considering an investment track in your view?
In terms of data points, the important thing to look at is that's something that the company provides is data on motorcycle sales, the market share data, And that's something that we're getting on a quarterly basis from the company, and also the data on market as a whole. There's also a great source, IHS, that provides the information on motorcycle market as a whole, which I think is quite interesting. And as long as all of the things that we're tracking remain within the historical ranges, we believe that the value on per share basis is going up, and the intrinsic value of the company is going up. So those are kind of the main things that we're looking at.
What risk would you say is top of mind for you with regard to your long-term thesis?
Well, it's clearly the health of the motorcycle market, because if I'm wrong and the demand for these type of motorcycles is permanently damaged and the size of the market is permanently smaller, then the value of the company is clearly less. I don't think that is the case, as I was talking about before. One of the reasons why I don't think it's the case is because even though the number of new motorcycles sold is lower, the number of total motorcycles on the road is going up. Also, if we're looking at the number of cruiser and touring motorcycles, which is the ones that are relevant to Harley-Davidson, those numbers, those motorcycles as percent of all motorcycles on the road have been staying steady around 60%, if I remember correctly. So there's been some changes from a point of view of what kind of motorcycles people buy, but those touring and cruising motorcycles have been staying around the same level.
And Steve, I know that Harley-Davidson is quite unique, and that reflects to some extent the wide moat that it has. But if you had to name a few public companies that one might look at as perhaps comparables, just in terms of the valuation, the relative valuation, what companies would you highlight?
So Polaris is clearly one, which is they're not just in motorcycles, they're also in ATVs, and they just bought a fairly large boat company, but they are operating in the same space, and it's clearly a good comp, especially because of the Indian motorcycle line that they have. I believe there's also Yamaha that's trading in Asia. But that's a different type of motorcycle, and those type of motorcycles, the Suzuki's and the Yamaha, those are really more of a commodity. Another company that's an interesting comp, slightly different market, but a similar premium perception, is Piaggio in Italy, that is the maker of Vespa.
Wonderful. Well, we will leave it there, Steve. Thank you so much for taking the time to articulate your thesis. And as you're showing here on the last slide, we have your contact information. And I would just encourage participants to feel free to follow up with you with their own thoughts and questions.
John, thank you very much for the opportunity. And thanks again for listening.
Thank you and goodbye.